Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to you all. We just went back an hour this morning, so we're back to 11 hours in between Ireland and Australia. We're going to think a little bit about the gospel reading that we heard today. And this gospel reading is in two parts. We're going to think about the second part first. First part we hear, as they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised." And then it says about the disciples, "And they were greatly distressed." And then there's the second part, this bit about that strange temple tax. When they reached Capernaum, the collectors of the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" And Peter says, "Yeah, he does." And then when they come home to Capernaum, Jesus spoke of it first. And Jesus says to Simon, "What do you think? From whom do the kings of earth take toll or tribute? From their children or from others?" And Simon Peter says, "From others." And Jesus says, "Well, the children are free, so that we don't give offence to them. Go to the sea and cast a hook." And then there's that strange little thing about the fish with the coin in its mouth. I suppose the text is very interesting. It's from Matthew, and in Matthew's gospel, there are five long sermons. That's how Matthew's gospel is structured. They're called discourses as well. And ultimately, the structure of five long sermons is the heart of Matthew's work. And Matthew, you know, has these long sermons and then squeezes all these other bits in between, these kind of stories that in other gospels go on for a bit longer. Matthew squeezes them all. And that is the structure. And at this stage, in this part of Matthew's gospel, there have been three sermons already, and we're at the bits where the anxiety about Jesus's authority are being explored. I always think that the Jesus of Matthew is a little bit like a Presbyterian. He likes very long sermons. And I also think that the Jesuses from the different gospels probably would have had things to say about the other ones. They're quite different characters, the way they're written. Mark's Jesus is really interested in action. Action, boom, go. And he uses lots of secrecy and doesn't give many sermons at all. Luke's Jesus is on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Luke's Jesus is a lover of the law and is critical of people who've denied it. John's Jesus is filled with two things. The first, a deep sense of identity as being divine. And the second, emotions, love for friends and tears. And then back to Matthew's Jesus. Matthew's Jesus has messages for people and is profoundly loyal to his followers, whether they understand him or not. So the Jesus of Matthew is phenomenally intelligent in theological queries, and there's a lot of them in Matthew's gospel. And the Jesus of Matthew is very loyal to the law, even if he is critical about how others have interpreted the law. The Jesus of Matthew is more than likely a Pharisee, and it's a really important thing for us to recognize the dignity of who the Pharisees were. The Jesus of Matthew knows exactly what's happening in the debates among the Pharisees. And not only the Pharisees, but also the Sadducees and the scribes and the lawyers. And here there's this other group, the collectors of the temple tax. Different groups come to Jesus throughout the Gospels, looking at the question of his authority. Sometimes it's a trap. We see that later on in Matthew's Gospel. But sometimes it's genuine curiosity. How do you figure this out while we're under the thumb of the Romans? And there's a mixture of reasons and queries and powers and plays and traps and threats and seeking for learning that's happening, depending as to who is coming and when. And so here we have this piece of the text. I'll read it again. When they reached Capernaum, the collectors of the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" So this question about the temple tax is a debate among the Pharisees and among others about the temple tax during this time. And it's important to know a tiny bit about the temple tax in order to figure out this text. Some people thought that you should only pay the temple tax if you felt like it, about once a year. And then other people felt like you should pay the temple tax more frequently, but at your own discretion. It shouldn't be collected. It should be voluntary. And then still others felt like there should be a group of people set up to collect the temple tax just once a year. And then still others felt like, no. We need a group of people set up to collect the temple tax on a frequent basis. And so, first of all, this sounds like every church or community group that I've ever been part of. there's always going to be people who say, oh, look, here's a good idea. And somebody else go, great, I'll set up a committee to control it. And other people were like, no, I don't want a committee to control it. And other people were like, yes, we need to collect that. I'm going to write down who does this. And other people are going to say, no, 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 stop restricting me. You're always going to find that in every church or community group around the place, that different people in the group kind of split into different ways about how much can or can't we control the way that we are together. And then there's those who want to test everyone based on their adherence to the scandal of the day. We see this as well, not just about the small things. What do you think about X or Y or Q or W issue? And based on that, they want to make a decision about whether you're in or out. And in this text, we see something really interesting. Jesus comes home. What an interesting thing. It does seem like Jesus had a home in Capernaum, the same home that the roof had been lifted off by the friends of the man who was being lowered into the house. But here's the text. And when he came home, Jesus spoke of it first, the temple tax, asking, what do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tribute? From their children or from others? Then Peter says, from others. And Jesus says to him, then the children are free. However, so that we do not give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook. Take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you'll find a coin. Take that and give it to them for you and me. So it's all a little bit mad. There's an internal debate about the temple tax that's splitting residents of the community. And there's those temple tax people. And there's this interesting thing that they don't go to Jesus, they go to Peter. Then there's this little parable question, from whom do the kings of the earth take their toll or tribute? And then there's that damned fish. But hidden among it is a question about whether you should or shouldn't pay this voluntary tax. Jesus kind of implies that he doesn't think it's the best, but he has other things that are more important. I'm going to say it three times, that strange little line in the middle of it. However, so that we do not give offense to others. However, so that we do not give offense to others. However, so that we do not give offense to others. In a certain light, we can think that Jesus is saying to Peter and to anybody else who is listening, and also implying about the temple tax, listen, the drama about the temple tax isn't my drama. Jesus is saying, I have dramas, but I'm not going to make every drama the main thing that I'm going to pay attention to. And so because he has other work, he's saying, look, here's a coin. It smells a little. A fish puked it up. So that we do not give offense. He's saying, go and cast the hook and take the first fish. So that we do not give offense. And then he says, take that and give it to the temple tax collectors. For you and me. I love that line. In a certain sense, this is an instruction to Peter, who can be a very impetuous person. In other gospel texts, we hear that Peter cuts the ear off somebody when the drama is rising. Jesus has a clear-eyed view about what's happening in conflict and drama. And Peter can be quite impetuous. And in a certain sense, this seems to be an invitation to Peter to say, fight only the important fights. Don't take everything. Don't be so quick to anger that you're going to get furious about everything. You know, if you need to say, look, I don't care about the temple tax, but I've got a coin here, take it. You know, in a certain sense, Jesus gives Peter something to say. You didn't have this coin before. You have it now. Hand it over. It'll leave them alone. We've got work to do. Jesus is saying people have dramas. And don't give the wrong dramas power over you by getting so involved with scandal and outrage. Don't be addicted to conflict. So this small text, in a certain sense, does highlight something about Jesus' approach to conflict. It's really important to notice that Jesus wasn't frightened of conflict. Often he amplified conflict. He did not always turn away from it. Sometimes, though, he did avoid conflict that he wasn't interested in, or conflict that he just thought was boring, because there were conflicts he couldn't avoid. Conflict that showed, like your liturgy earlier on, showed that sometimes people use power to dominate and weaknesses to manipulate, and pursuing our desires at the expense of others. this text from the Gospels, I think, is not an invitation to totally check out of conflict, but it is a call not to let the fruitless conflict ruin you. Saying that there's all kinds of outrages. Sometimes there's outrage for outrage's sake. How can we be a people who pay attention to thinking, is that going to be drama? Is that drama going to be helpful? There are important things, serious injustices in the world. Do I want to get caught up in a small drama that's actually just about keeping people feeling at the center of the state? Certain cycles in neighbors and in countries and in churches have repeated cycles of drama and conflict that continue because it continues. We heard this in the first reading as well, in the story from the book of Numbers, the arguments between the Israelites and the Moabites. People are holding things against people between these two peoples for so long they forget who started what, but they know the other side is to blame. There's that strange line when Balaam says to the donkey, "If I had a sword, I'd kill you now." One of the things that this text is showing is that Balaam, who in some ways is being portrayed as somebody who can hear the voice of God, how close aggression and anger is to the surface of him. "If I had a sword, I'd kill you now." And then suddenly the sword repeats itself. An angel with a sword. And so Balaam, who was saying, "I wish I had a sword because I'd kill the donkey," suddenly realizes, "Oh, somebody bigger than me has a sword." But that angel has a message. And the angel is saying, just because you have a sword or power, it doesn't mean you should use it. In the book of Romans, the letter to the Romans, there's a beautiful line in chapter 12. "If possible, as much as it depends on you, be at peace with everyone." I think that can be a really important line in an era where I think we can become quite addicted to outrage. There are things to be outraged at, but not everything. We don't need to become outraged at the neighbours and at what happened on the television and all of these things. There are injustices in the world. The treatment of people seeking asylum, the treatment of Indigenous people, the denial of colonisation. These are things to pay attention to and to elevate the conflict about. But sometimes we can become filled with conflict that the church changed the time of meeting, or the colour of the wall and the church got painted a different colour, and the outrage can just spark everywhere. I think the Gospels call people to be focused in their conflict, to not allow conflict to control you, to invite us. Every little reflection on argument in the Gospel is, in a certain sense, a reflection on power and the ultimate abuse of power, which we find in the crucifixion. And this gospel text today began with a reflection on the crucifixion. Jesus tells the distressed disciples that he's about to die. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands and they will kill him. And on the third day, he will be raised. And then it says of the disciples, they were greatly distressed. Now, we can read this and feel slightly judgmental of the disciples because they didn't understand. But we do because we know the story. Instead, though, I'd like us to reflect on they were greatly distressed. They should have been. This was torture. This was a Roman imagination about how to kill and humiliate a person in public. It was torture. And we idolize the cross sometimes, even though the cross is empty. And I'm not making a point up here about Catholics and Protestants as to whether Jesus is or isn't in the cross in terms of our the visuals of it. But the cross, in many ways, shows us that the story of God, the story of love, was unable to be killed by death. The cross doesn't end human violence. It reveals it. It shows us how empty human violence is, that people, when they're threatened, try to dominate other people. But even in dominating, there are certain things we can't kill, which is love, and love continues and continues. I want to leave you with a short reflection, a short poem, really, reflecting on the Stations of the Cross. Jesus phones the Samaritans. I'm always curious about who in our world today is getting to the stage when they're saying, "I need to phone somebody and I don't know who to talk to." So they think about a therapist, or they think about a phone helpline, or maybe they text a friend. They reach out for help. And I think there's all kinds of small crucifixions happening among us here. Everybody here will have their own burdens they're carrying today. So here's a sonnet, a short one, called "Jesus Phones the Samaritans." Jesus phones the Samaritans. Samaritans, how can I help? Of course I'm happy to talk. What name can I call you? You don't need to say anything. That's quite all right. I'm in no rush. I'm just a set of ears for you. It might help you if you tell me what's happening. But even if you don't, that's okay. You're welcome to tell me more. What will you do after you hang up? I'm not here to tell you what to do. Are you feeling at the end of yourself? You can call us any time, night or day. Yes, I'm still here. As I think of people who work on the other end of phone lines, one of the things that I know they do is that in the face of people's serious dramas, they know that calm and lack of fear and walking without fear into the pain of other people's lives is something that can de-escalate the drama that people feel like they're in, that can make them feel desperate and do desperate things. And I think the Samaritans truly are demonstrating what it means to be unafraid and unaddicted to conflict, and to know that in spaces of conflict, one of the things we need is to not let conflict control us, to not let drama control us, and in a different sense, to be in control of the dramas that try to take over our lives, to find a way with graciousness, with kindness, knowing that I can't dictate everything, but thinking what I do know is listening and learning and making space and making help and saying, I don't know if I can solve anything, but I'm still listening and I'm still here and you can always come back. But these are the interventions. And over again, what we see in the Gospels is that people are looking all the way to be outraged at something unhelpful. And Jesus is saying, not everything is worthwhile losing your shit about. Find ways to pay attention to what's going on and only get outraged at the things that where you're able to do something. This isn't saying check out and just saying, no, I'm not getting involved in anything at all. This is saying pay attention and know how not to let the outrage control you. I know there's a lot of things politically that we're paying attention to across the world. Mr. Trump demonstrates a lot of outrage and in a certain sense creates a stage for himself by keeping himself on that damn stage. What would it be like for him to have to face up to the fact that actually people just want to forget him? In the face of that, no wonder he says outrageous things so that our attention goes to him. And it happens more locally too, in our parishes, in our communities, in our own politics. We see the exaggeration of male egos, fragile egos, that are enjoying being loud and demanding our attention and drama and outrage. What would it be like to say, I won't give you the thing that you most desire, which is my heart, which is my attention. I won't give it because you're not important enough. You are an empty bell. Here, take a coin. Fine. Be satisfied. Piss off. I've got work to do. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.